Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In terms of Aaron Rodgers and what would his legacy be in Green Bay, would he be despised like Brett Favre was for the better part of a decade, or would people blame management for letting him get away? If Aaron Rodgers went to San Francisco and then the Packers proceeded to own Aaron Rodgers in the San Francisco 49ers every time they faced him with Trey Lance as the quarterback, Aaron Rodgers would end up being despised by the Packers. And almost in a way that I don't think he could ever be loved again. Like, I think they would forgive him eventually and they would respect him for the Super Bowl that he won. Mm-hmm. But I think that it would be one of those things where, wait a second, you put us through all of this for that? You know, mm-hmm. Shame on you, Aaron Rodgers. Whereas if he leaves and the Packers aren't good for 5 to 10 years, ultimately I think Packers fans will blame Packers management for not salvaging the relationship.
So that would, like, okay. So if he leaves and they're not good, it'll be like, okay, he was the reason. He was the sole reason that we were successful as we were. I got you.
So earlier in the show, we talked about how Adam Schefter is getting a lot of heat because it turns out he chose to break the news about Aaron Rodgers wanting out of Green Bay on draft morning. And there's even more conflict because on draft morning, he reported that ESPN had learned things on Thursday morning. Then yesterday, he goes on the Dan Patrick show and says that, no, it was all just an accumulation of information I'd had over time. And reports were starting to trickle out, so I went ahead and released my news on Thursday morning. So he's gotten a whole lot of heat, and I understand it because, frankly, it took a whole lot of attention away from the draft itself. It could have theoretically, potentially altered the actual picks that some teams had. Right. I think that in hindsight, that's not likely. But at the time, it felt like, man, this could alter some teams' plans. You know, the Green Bay got at least one call inquiring about Aaron Rodgers on that day. Who knows if they would have gotten that call without Adam Schefter reporting what he did. But the thing that it made me wonder, Cecil, as Cecil Shorts fills in for Sean Pendergast today, Cecil Shorts, former Texans wide receiver, the thing that it made me wonder is, did the Sports Illustrated articles about Jack Easterby that came out during the season, particularly the first one, could that article have actually altered the course of the next couple months? And is there a chance that we wouldn't have been in the situation we were in pre-lawsuit with Deshaun Watson if it hadn't been for those Sports Illustrated articles?
No, because what was in those articles, I think it may not have went mainstream if it wasn't for the article.
Yeah.
But we would have heard about it, and people would still be upset about it. It still happened. It was still known within the building through players, through, you know, whoever staff members are. So it was still going on. So I still think we would be in the situation where Deshaun or whoever else still be upset and they would still be going things inside. It just wouldn't be to the world what actually was going on. Makes sense?
I guess, and I agree with that part because I'd heard enough and felt enough and felt strongly about it. I mean, when Bill O'Brien got fired, I felt and I tweeted and I did videos about how I felt like that was only 50% of the job. I felt like Jack Easterby needed to be removed because he was part of, as the team's website itself says it, he was part of reshaping that roster, and this roster right now, or as it was in December, was not a good roster. All of that was true, but the part I wonder about was in terms of public sentiment and just how – perhaps pro Deshaun people were at the beginning of things. A lot of that was based on the fact that people were so anti-Easterby at that point.
Yeah.
And they had seen the dysfunction in that Sports Illustrated article that I felt like more people decided with Deshaun than might normally have, and maybe that emboldened Deshaun.
Yeah, I'm with you now. I think that there will be a lot less people understanding of how Deshaun wanted to get out if it wasn't for the article. I think it would be a lot less like, he's just, you know, boom, 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 boom. I just feel like that article definitely hyped up, or not hyped up, but kind of just informed everybody what was really going on inside the building and why Deshaun felt the way he felt. Right, so everybody kind of got a perspective from where he was feeling or what the players were feeling. Now they put themselves in that perspective. They're like, oh, okay, so now I see what's going on and why this is going the way it's going on. But they would have never known about it. I agree with you. It would be a lot less people on his side. They'd probably be like, why does he want to get out? Why is this? Why is that? So that, yeah, that's interesting. That right there is something that's interesting.
You know, to kind of put it in perspective, I'd heard things and I knew and wondered about some things the whole time. It wasn't until after the Sports Illustrated article came out that any players actually reached out to me. And the first day we were talking about, one of the first days we were talking about that Sports Illustrated, I guess it was maybe when the second article came out. So this was after Deshaun Watson had already demanded the trade. It was on January 6th of this year, a player reached out to me and said, you've been spot on from the start. It is as we were talking about the Jack Easterby situation and exactly how Easterby was influencing the team and what it meant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I learned more and more over time about how it wasn't just some media creation whatsoever. This was multiple players. There was a severe amount of weirdness in that organization that I'm with you. Everything in the Sports Illustrated articles, I pretty much believe any of the quotes from the players. The one thing that I'm a little bit skeptical of, and this is where I felt like maybe the editors at Sports Illustrated should have changed things a little bit, was when they reported that some players, they almost reported it like a fact that the team was sending private eyes out to follow players, when that was more of a, like, it was players, a couple players saying they felt like maybe that's what had happened. There were a couple little reporting items that I felt like were phrased a little bit differently that might have been inaccurate. But in terms of how the players actually felt and how multiple players felt like Jack Easterby was bad for the organization of all that stuff, yeah, that was definitely true. And I think that Deshaun, at the very beginning of it at least, I think there was some part of him that felt like he was going to speak up for the players themselves, and that he was a guy that could do it where other guys with a lot of power might not be able to do it.
That is – so let me ask you this. Do you feel like the role that Easterby has now is more fitting for him, according to what Caserio said? He's not involved in any football operations, right?
Yeah,
anything that's going on, that's more fitting for him than him being involved in any type of way. Would you agree with that?
I'm sorry. Rephrase it or say it again.
Do you feel like his role now would help? Put it this way. Is his role now better for players to understand and take him in and build that relationship back than before?
Yeah, I think 100%. Now this is the weird thing about Easterby, and this is why. Everybody was so freaked out and why he was regarded so much differently than he was in New England. I mean, for one, there was just the timing of it. Like Andre Johnson said, Easterby showed up, and then afterwards, everything kind of seemed to slowly unravel when you look at the strangeness of the deals, the fact that Brian Gain was fired, all of that. Like, people within the organization could put two and two together and realize that Easterby had a whole lot of power. But then there was this strange element where, as one player told me, Easterby was just always there. Like, you'd go in to meet with Bill O'Brien, and Easterby was sitting there in the corner. with a notepad taking notes. So Easterby was this mysterious figure that in New England, he was the high five guy. He was nothing but Mr. Positivity, where all of a sudden in Houston, he became a guy who, you know, on one side of his mouth was trying to preach positivity, but on the other side of his mouth, or at least by his mere physical presence, players were looking at him and being like, this guy's the hatchet man, you know? What the hell? What's going on here? What is this guy? What is his role? And then there's the increased weirdness of him addressing the team on Saturday nights before games and kind of trying to talk about football stuff, but without really necessarily knowing what he was talking about. Yeah. All of that made what was a traditionally bad situation that much worse and that much weirder. Like, Cecil, have you ever seen the show, the movie North Dallas 40?
No.
Oh, okay. So this is it's a movie with Nick Nolte, and it's kind of loosely based off the Cowboys. It's a team in Dallas, and there's all kinds of, you know, stuff that was going on in the 70s, guys getting pressured to get shots of cortisone in their knees, you know, other guys getting followed by private detectives and stuff. It was all this really weird stuff that you felt like was completely exaggerated for Hollywood's sake. Mm-hmm. Like, everything was an extreme version of, like, the dirty, shady tactics that the team used. And there was one scene where the preacher gets up and starts addressing the team and is, like, just doing one of these weird, like, half pep talk, half sermon, and it was just bizarre. That's what it felt and sounds like things were like with the Houston Texans. Everything was just super, super weird. If Easterby had just come in and been a little bit more behind the scenes and a little bit more like an actual player development coach, then, yeah, I think that when – I think that you would have had an interim head coach in Romeo Crennel. I think that people would have felt like, okay, hopefully we make some of the right decisions. But by then, the players, many of the players themselves had a perception that Cal McNair was just doing whatever Jack Easterby was telling him to do, and that they weren't all that convinced that Jack Easterby had a clue how to do things. So, yeah, that's when you get to late December and Deshaun Watson feels like the train is completely off the rails.
Can he rebuild it back, though? Can he get his relationship back? Can he get back to being just a player development guy and then guys buy into what he's doing his new role?
Or
his
best role? I think so, because I think that's how they're going to present it. I mean, and it sounds like that's more of what his actual role is now that Caserio is there.
Right.
The biggest question I have is just why. This has been the weirdest offseason. We've talked so little about David Culley himself. And, like, what the heck is David Culley even? Like, I don't know exactly who he is as a coach. What is he going to be like as a coach? We have these huge questions, and it's like we really don't even think about it all that much. So sometimes I think about, instead, things that I do like. Like Jose Altuve. The Astros won in the Bronx yesterday. Was it bigger for Altuve than just perhaps breaking out of a slump? We'll weigh in with Cecil Shorts next. So some of you might have not realized that the Astros were playing yesterday afternoon, because even by afternoon standards, it was an early, early game. But I got to watch all of it. It was nice to not be sleepy during a baseball game. It's the exact opposite of any of these West Coast games. As Cecil Shorts joins us. And Cecil, your kids are back in school, right? So you're at least the older ones are in school, so you can actually enjoy an afternoon baseball game.
No. So I do some teaching at my kids' school. So I'm like,
oh,
I'm
you
like
do?
I'm like the PE teacher over there. So I finished up my degree this year. In education, I'm like the PE teacher over there. So they let me do my student teaching over there, and they kind of carry out the student teachers over. They hired me on for the rest of the year. So it was pretty cool. Yeah. So I actually don't get that time. I got classes.
You're actually working. Oh, that's right. I didn't realize that you were doing that. Are you gonna go into like coaching or teaching full time? Do you think?
You know what? We're working on that now. So we'll see what happens with that. But, yeah, we're thinking about going into it full time. I coached last year at Second Baptist High School, which was a lot of fun. So we'll see where that goes. We'll see where that goes. I think that's the goal right now, to be full time teacher. I'm messing my dad did for like 20, 25. He's still doing it, 20 plus years. Now I'm just used to it, just being around kids. And he had a bunch of kids himself.
But
it's just fun. It's just fun coaching and teaching and helping young men and women is just something I like to do.
Yeah, you should do it. You know what? I was watching this John Adams miniseries on HBO last night, which is a really good miniseries. But John Adams was talking to one of his sons, and he talks about the importance of going into public service, because if intelligent men turn down these roles in public service, they will be filled by somebody else. Mm. So I feel like you have a knack for teaching, and you've got the right personality for it. So you almost have a duty and an obligation, Cecil, to become a teacher and a coach, because you can mold young minds. And if you don't do it, some clown's going to do it who's not as good as you at it. But it might be me screaming at these kids, losing my patience and my temper. Now get out there and don't disappoint me. That's my motivational tactic. Don't embarrass me out there, you little punk. So Cecil Shorts filling in for Sean Pendergast. Look, the Astros won yesterday. It was about as happy as you could be after winning one of three, because of everything that was all wrapped up in this series and the booing, the chanting, all this vitriol focused really mostly on the Astros infielders that remained from 2017, but especially on Jose Altuve. So Jose, who struggled up to this point in the series, hits a home run, and it felt like you could hear the entire city of Houston relax. Yeah. A little bit, or exhale a little bit. Cecil, what? I try not to make too much of body language and everything, especially with Jose Altuve, because he's never been a guy that, you know, struts around or anything. And I was a little bit in denial. This series, I felt for him. I mean, do you think that home run could have released some of the weight off his shoulders, or do you think this is going to be season long? It's going to potentially affect him.
I think this could start to help get the weight off his shoulders. I think, and you know, being a former athlete, there's times where it's so mental. Everything is so much in your head. You have the ability. You have the skill. You know what you're doing. You know the play. You know what you got to do. But in your mind, you're battling with yourself. You're battling with the outside forces. You're battling with so much stuff that your play is taking a downhill. So for me, when I see him hit that home run after his slump, I think he was, 3-for-24 or something before that, something crazy. And then going back to last year, like I mentioned earlier in the show, with the stuff he dealt with at the plate and then with the yips in the playoffs, to see him hit that home run in the big situation, to understand what was going on, how you broke it down earlier, how the Yankees can't stand him for winning MVP, how the Yankees can't stand him for his performance in the playoffs, how the Yankees fans and other fans literally blame Jose Altuve for everything that went on, the cheating scandal. And to put that all on your shoulders and to be able to hold that there is tough. And for him, you can just see in his body language, he doesn't show a lot of emotion, but you can see in his body language, it was wearing on him. You can see, like, it was tough for him in the post-game interviews, like, yeah, you know, I didn't, boom, boom, boom. It's just so much that goes into it. Being a former player, I've been there. I've seen that. I've dealt with it. I've seen other players deal with it. So I'm hoping this can be a start to be like, okay, let's get things going in the right path. Let's get back to being Jose Altuve. Let's get back being the great player that you are. Because, I mean, for a while, people are talking about he's going to be the Mr. 3000. He's on his way to be super special. It's just, you know, right now he's going through this slump or whatever. So I'm hoping this can turn things around for him because, you know, it's all mental.
It is. Yeah, and it was, I mean, I think Altuve is going to age pretty well. Like, I feel like smaller guys tend to age better. There's not as much stress on the joints. And his game should age well. He turned 31 yesterday, so it was a nice birthday present for him. But the mental side of things, especially in baseball, Cecil, it seems like you really hear baseball players, both hitters and pitchers alike, talk a lot about trying to remember, okay, let me look back to when things were going well for me. What was I doing then? How can I replicate that? And it's almost now to the point with Altuve where it's been such a long stretch where he's been the face of this scandal so much that I worry that in some ways he won't be able to remember actually what it was like when he was playing really well and when he was MVP caliber Jose Altuve. The thing that it encouraged me yesterday, or really in this entire series, right from the get-go, 3 days ago, 4 days ago, was that he was very adept in the field. He was making, you brought up the yips in the playoffs last year. Mm-hmm. There was no hint of that whatsoever. So I could tell that at the very least when he was out in the field, the bleep Altuve chants and everything weren't affecting him. But I do, there's part of me that just wishes, man, I wish somehow Bregman could become the face of the scandal, because Bregman would love it.
Oh, he'll eat it up.
some guys are just engineered for it,
yes.
Right? Like, some guys just, Bregman just doesn't care. Correa, I think, to a certain degree, but I think Bregman, more than any of those guys, just really doesn't care.
He would be able to handle it better than anybody because he would just, I mean, like you mentioned, some guys are built for that. Some guys want that. Some guys feed off the criticism, where other guys, I'm not saying Altuve can't, but he's just, you know, he's not necessarily, that's not his style. That's not something that he would rather have to go through. And then especially because it seems like he had nothing to do with it.
I know. And I explain that every time as Cecil Shorts fills in for Sean Pendergast today. I try to remember to explain that every time because that's a part of the cheating scandal that some people, maybe they just got sick of it and they checked out or they don't realize, is that based on player interviews, data from like the Fangraphs and stuff, and then the study that the Astros fan did where he actually went back and monitored the audio of all those games in 2017, it looks like you could very credibly believe that Josh Reddick, Tony Kemp, and Jose Altuve did not participate in the cheating scandal. And I'm not even saying that any of those guys were morally superior or anything. Maybe Altuve just didn't like it. Maybe he tried it and it didn't work for him or what have you. It's just, but that he didn't. So it's just ironic that he becomes the face of it. And almost because he's such a good dude, he gets it even harder because he won't stand up and separate himself from the team and defend himself. Yeah. He just says, I'm going to take this along with the rest of the team.
Let me ask you this, because I know baseball to me is like more of a mental game than any other sport. And I think partially because you have to wait so long in between your at-bats or wait so long in between your when you may get the ball, right? So as a receiver, I may drop two passes, but I might get 10 targets throughout the game. You know what I mean? You're not getting 10 at-bats in a baseball game, right? In basketball, you miss a shot, guess what? You can come out and shoot again or shoot again and shoot again. You might get 15, 20, 25 shots depending on who you are. But in baseball, it really like you might get only two at-bats the whole game, three at-bats, and then you got to wait maybe, I don't know, three innings before you get to bat again depending on how the game's going. Yeah. And it's just so mental compared to other sports where you can bounce back quickly and where you have to bounce back quickly.
And I almost feel like I know people have pointed to the fact that there were only 10,000 fans at Yankee Stadium, and what would it be like if there were 50,000? I've tried to put myself in that situation, and honestly, sometimes it's a lot easier when you've got an entire stadium booing you versus a smaller stadium. And I'm going to say specifically, it's never the boos that penetrate your psyche. It's the individual heckler.
It's the one individual.
That individual, man. And like you might ignore him or something, but every now and then they crack through.
Yes.
And that one individual gets you. And I feel like if there were 50,000 people, it's going to be a cacophony of hecklers, you know, like people. And then it all just becomes kind of white noise. When there's only 10,000 people there, that means that there might be like two, three, or four who have like really loud voices and that come up with some really good stuff. The funny guys are the ones that really, the ones that somehow really cut to the bone. They're like skilled seventh graders in how they cut you down and figure out what your weakness is. That's where I wonder if that makes it even worse, because it is, you can hear that lone voice that's saying something, and it's harder to just tune that out.
It's harder to tune out. And for whatever reason, they know exactly when to say it and what to say.
Yeah.
And you're like, and you want to like ignore, be like, what did he just say? Or what did she just say? God,
if I were gonna try to get Altuve, like if I were a Yankees fan or something, God help me. I think what I would try. The ideal scenario would be if, like, you've got a really good Venezuelan accent. Not just that you're fluent in Spanish, but if you could speak like a native Venezuelan, that would cut through everything else immediately, right?
Oh, that would stand out for sure.
That would all of a sudden, like, that would catch your ear, and it would be hard to ignore that. So, yeah, I've kind of been in denial about how much it might be affecting Jose specifically. I don't think the rest of the players, I don't think it matters as much because they don't get singled out. But Altuve, because of his personality and because he's being singled out, I feel kind of bad for him. Look, we talked about this a little earlier, and this is a question that is I'm really struggling with myself, is what are the three biggest non-Deshaun Watson questions facing the Texans right now? I realize we've been neglecting the absolute biggest question of them all. We'll talk about that next. So as I was sitting down last night preparing for Sean Pendergast to be gone, Sean Pendergast is off watching both of his sons graduate. Sammy's graduating from Baylor. James Pendergast. James already graduated, but he didn't get to walk through the ceremony, so he's doing that. So, boy, that probably takes on special significance when you've actually been out there in the real world working at a job and everything, and then you get to go back to your fantasy world of being in college and walking across the stage again. That's a special moment. Plus, you remember, this is what I was always amazed by, is Cecil Shorts fills in for Sean Pendergast. Cecil, when guys would come back to school, like maybe some guy that was a senior when I was a sophomore would come back to school a couple years later when I was still in college, they'd come back and they'd like buy pizza for the whole group or something and beer. And we'd act like they were the richest people on earth. Like, holy crap. He just bought pizza and beer for everybody. The whole, like all six of us. This guy's loaded. He's rolling in it. Like, what's it like living like a rock star?
Good times.
Poor and hungry in college. But I was thinking about this. We really have zero clue what to expect from David Culley as a football coach. And we barely talked about it because Deshaun Watson, because of Jack Easterby, because of Nick Caserio. And Culley, you know, Culley's father passed away. I'm not criticizing him for not really being available or present during the draft, obviously. His father passed away during the draft. But in general, we just really haven't seen or heard a whole lot of him. I'll ask you, What should I expect from David Culley as a head football coach in the NFL?
Well, I don't know why you're asking me.
Because he was a receivers coach, Cecil. And you're an NFL wide receiver. So you should know.
I should what know, does right? this is tough, right? I know he's an awesome guy. That's one thing we talked about offline. Everybody says the same thing. He's an amazing person, right?
Yeah.
But amazing person doesn't mean you're going to win games.
I mean, she's a great lady. Yeah.
Amazing person doesn't mean you're going to win games. Doesn't mean you can lead men. He has no experience at calling plays. He has no experience at being put in situations and knowing when to go for it on fourth down and no situational football. So it's like everything we'll learn from him, he'll be learning at the same time. So we'll be learning him together as long as he learns himself. So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out because he's never had any experience.
Well, and this is where him being 65 years old concerns me. I don't mind if you hire a 65-year-old coach. I mean, hell, Houston has had a bunch of older coaches in basketball, in baseball, and now in football. In basketball and baseball, it's worked out pretty well, you know? Yeah. I was happy with D'Antoni, or D'Antoni did a good enough job, an extremely competent job, but he'd been in the game continuously. I think when you go Dusty Baker's been in the game continuously. Yeah. Now, David Culley has been in the game continuously, but those other two guys have been in the game making those decisions.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Setting those rosters.
Yeah.
Make the decisions, and that's the big thing, is making decisions when the pressure is on you. It's one thing to be doing it when you're sitting on the couch or when you're the assistant coach and you're watching and maybe you're advising Andy Reid or Jim Harbaugh. But it's a whole lot different when you're the guy. So I'm okay when you hire a non-coordinator, you know, or like John Harbaugh was a special teams coordinator, but he's gone on to be a very competent and good head coach. Mike Tomlin had barely been a defensive coordinator when he got hired to be the Steelers head coach. But he ended up being a very good head coach. With David Culley, I just have no idea what to expect when it comes down to fourth down aggressiveness, in-game decision-making. Tell me if this is too optimistic. Coming from Baltimore, Baltimore has one of the most advanced analytics departments in the league. Do you think that Culley, maybe having seen that, is cool with the analytics department calling the shots when it comes down to fourth down decision-making and whatnot?
Is he cool with it?
He's got to be cool with it, right?
I would assume he's cool with it, but I don't know if he would rather call the shots because I don't know if he would agree with it, right? Just because you're cool with it don't mean you would agree with everything the analytics says. For me, when it comes to Culley, what I'm worried about is will he be the main voice in the locker room? Like, will people listen to him? Or would it be somebody like Pep Hamilton? Would it be like a Lovie Smith that people have that, you know, people respect, not respect more, but they've done more per se when it comes mm-hmm. to their roles than David Culley. He has a final say, of course, but they may listen to Lovie Smith more because he's been the head coach and been to a Super Bowl long, and then during that time span where Culley was just a positional coach. Nothing wrong with positional coach, but I'm just saying this, it's like levels to, as a player, would I listen to that guy more or this guy when it comes to certain situations, you know?
For Culley to work out, I mean, aside from the issue that he's going to have with the roster immediately, it's going to have to be that his human elements and his ability to, because it's not about pep talks, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not about mm-hmm. pep talks. Pep talks are nice and it's cool and they keep things lively and fun at times. But over time, like, there's nothing worse than a pep talk from a coach that you don't respect. I mean, then it gets the exact opposite. It becomes detrimental. Like, please don't tell me, don't give me a pep talk. Just tell me what to do. And I think, like, honestly, and you just played this piece of audio for me during the break. This is Nick Caserio calling Davis Mills and then handing the phone over to David Culley. Every time I hear David Culley, for the most part, I end up feeling probably the way Davis Mills does after this call.
Great. Where are you at? Nice. Pretty quiet? All right. Okay, great. All right, we're gonna turn the pick in here in a minute, and we're going to make you a Houston Texan. You know, we're excited to have you. Like, you're a good player. You know, you've had a good career at Stanford, and, you know, you're the type of person that we want to have in the building. So, you know, we're excited. Enjoy it with your family. We'll circle back with you here in a little bit. Coach Culley is sitting right next to me here. He's going to get on the phone. So we'll visit with you here in a little bit. But congratulations.
Davis. David Culley, head football coach, Texas. How you doing? You should be. Hey, listen. Love the thought of you being a Texan. I mean, we can't wait to get you here. I hear him in the background. I hear him. Yeah, tell him, get him some boots now, okay? Hey, well, listen, looking forward to it. Congratulations. Happy for you. I couldn't be, as a first-time head coach, I couldn't be more happy for you.
My only criticism there, Cecil, is that you can definitely get by in Houston without owning a pair of cowboy boots.
Absolutely.
But I feel bad. Look, it's not like the third rounders are, you know, getting generational wealth or anything. I hope he didn't go out and buy nice cowboy boots for all of his family members.
Well, he went to Stanford. We're assuming he's smart, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I've got assumptions about people from California that aren't, you know, like,
you
I assume they all live like within a stone's throw of the beach and they all surf and all that. So when people do throw that out about Houston, about a cowboy or anything, and you're not from Houston, you probably just think, oh, okay, cool. It must be cowboy territory down there on the Gulf Coast. But we all know that about Culley at this point. Yeah, he's really likable. And there's reason that, like, his former players, like, we just don't know how is he going to be with clock management? I mean, this is an Andy Reid protege. I get a little bit nervous about that. So we'll see. I think in a lot of respects, kind of like Bo Porter did with the Astros, he's going to get a pass because so much of the focus right now is on the front office. Like, there's, I think that when you, and I'm still on Jack Easterby somewhat, and it, for the most part this first year, barring any egregious errors, I don't think that Culley's going to get the brunt of the criticism after losses.
Really?
No.
Well, is that because they don't think that he'll be here long term?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think part of it is the expectations are so low.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
Now this is where it might get interesting. Should the offense at least, with Tyrod Taylor at the helm,
okay,
should the offense at least be competent? I think it's fair to say that, yeah, the offense should at least be competent with Tyrod Taylor at the helm. Now, if the offense isn't functioning well at all and they end up being the worst offense in the league, I say competent, I mean, like, at least a credible offense. Like, you can score. You're not 31st or 32nd. If they end up 31st or 32nd in the league, then I think Pep Hamilton and and Tim Culley will get a lot of criticism, but I think ultimately that ends up on David Culley because he's an offensive-minded head coach.
Yeah, for sure. But to me, how do I want to put this? I do think the offense should be competent. You got Tyrod Taylor, you got Phillip Lindsay, you got David Johnson, you got Brandon Cooks, you got a good tight end room, so a decent offensive line. So I do think they will put up some decent numbers. I don't expect them to be last. I expect them to be somewhere between the middle of the pack to 23-ish. Mm-hmm. But the thing is here, when you got a guy that never called plays before, when you got a guy that's never been in that situation before, situational football, there's 2 minutes to go in the game and you're down six. Like, it is, I don't know about, I think he will get criticism as the year goes on because certain things may come up over and over and over again because he's a rookie. He's a rookie head coach and he's never been there before. So he's going to make a lot of mistakes. Early on, we'll give him grace. But as time goes on, he does not improve. We have to criticize what's going on.
Cecil Shorts filling in for Sean Pendergast today. The other two questions I had, as far as the three biggest non-Deshaun Watson questions, this is kind of related to Deshaun Watson. The second question would be, who's going to finish the season at quarterback? And when, if it is Davis Mills, do you go to Davis Mills?
I'm going to say that Tyrod Taylor starts the season. Because I'm assuming even if Watson comes back, it'll be some type of suspension. I'm assuming, right? I don't know. I'm just assuming. Tyrod would start, but if you look at every bridge quarterback, to me, they never finish the season. Look at Ryan Fitzpatrick. He lasted up until a certain point, then they'll put the rookie in. They'll last Tyrod Taylor with Baker Mayfield. He lasted to a certain point, then they put the rookie in. Even in last year, and even though he got hurt, and or he didn't get hurt, but they hurt him in with the Chargers. He was the guy up until Justin was ready. So I think Tyrod would be the guy until they feel like Davis is ready. Now, Davis is a Pep Hamilton guy. Luck at Stanford. He know he got a good relationship with Davis Shaw and those guys at Stanford. And if you look at Davis Mills' film, he kind of, I'm going to say this lightly, he kind of favors Andrew Luck as far as his body language, how he moves in the pocket, how he throws his stance. Like, that's what it is.
Yeah, a lot of other people have noticed that. And I think Pep Hamilton himself said that it looks like, you know, you can tell he's tried to model his game after Andrew Luck.
And it makes sense.
And when you see him in that same offense, it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
He just can't run like Andrew Luck.
No, not at all.
So it's everything before the play breaks down or before he has to run, it looks like Andrew Luck, right up until he starts trying to run.
So to answer the question, I would say Davis Mills finishes this season. When? Depending how the year goes, somewhere between week seven and eight-ish, before, probably right at midseason, they'll make the turn.
If somehow they make an improbable run at the playoffs or something with Tyrod Taylor, then it's going to be Tyrod Taylor, I think. I don't think they push it with Davis Mills. Maybe they do. Maybe
if they love him.
Could it be one of those situations where if the Texans make a run, there's a certain part of management's mind that's a little bit like, all right, guys, this wasn't the plan. We're trying to pick a quarterback high next year. So then they throw in Davis Mills at that point because it either sinks them and they end up still getting that high choice, or Davis Mills responds well and they do make a nice run and maybe you found something here.
I think at some point you got to see what he can do. At some point you have to see what he can do. Do you like him, especially if you're not playing well, right? If your season's not going as planned, at some point, okay, let's see what he can do. Let's see if he shows potential. If not, okay, we're going after Spencer Rattler or whoever. I don't know who the top quarterbacks will be next year.
The third question I was going to have is, as much as I've tried to just stop talking about Easterby, it was going to be, is Easterby qualified in his current role, and is the current role exactly the right place for him to be with the Texans? We can hit that a little bit later, and we've talked about it a little bit already. I want to hit what a texter asked, because this seems to be the perpetual question in the NFL, especially when there's a Stanford quarterback involved. What do you think if maybe the grand plan is to bring in Stanford head coach David Shaw as the head coach of the Texans in 2023 or 24?
Ooh, I actually like that. I think Shaw has been, I actually like that a lot.
He's turned down jobs before, right? He's turned down. He said he's not interested. I mean, for a while, it felt like David Shaw became the guy that some teams, I think, would conveniently talk about because they figured, like, all right, well, we'll check off the Rooney Rule box, but we know that David Shaw probably isn't going to come because he is – like, he's a lot of teams genuinely want David Shaw, but he seems so committed to staying at Stanford that I think a lot of people have given up on even trying to pull him out of it.
And I think he fits the mold of what Caserio wants to bring in the building, the type of guy he wants to bring into the building. So I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there's ways to convince guys like David Shaw. You got to give him a boatload of money. But there's definitely
turns into
there's definitely ways to convince him.
I wonder with Shaw, I mean, he seems like he's so dyed-in-the-wool, a Stanford guy. And it gets to that point where you either got to make the decision of, all right, somehow I'm going to figure out a win of a national championship with this group of nerds, or I'm just going to go off and try to make it my way some other kind of way. Like, hey, I went to a college where we played football with a bunch of nerds, but the difference was we were competing against other nerds.
Right.
There was a conference of all nerds. So that levels the playing field. Where Shaw is coaching a bunch of nerds against teams that aren't constrained by nerdiness.
Right.
And it's hard to actually push for the ultimate prize there. He just he seems to genuinely love Stanford.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, but I would be for that. I think it would be really, I think that David Shaw has been coaching a pro style system that's gone on to produce pro style quarterbacks and tight ends especially, and I would be all for that. I just don't think it's realistic. I don't think that the Texans are going to be the team that convinces David Shaw. If Andrew, well, let's see. The problem with Andrew Luck is, yeah, if did the Colts ever make a run at David Shaw?
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think they ever did. No. I mean, that would be the one that maybe could have worked. I think that, and I think maybe Andrew Luck would have been better off for it. Because the one thing about Bruce Arians is that he just doesn't give a damn about his quarterback getting hit. And some of Luck, like, that's Luck's psychology also, is like, yeah, I don't give a damn if I get hit.
Yeah.
I think over time that just started to obviously wear on Andrew Luck a little bit. Cecil brought up some things to me that made me feel a little bit more optimistic about Davis Mills and the situation he finds himself in. But I still have to ask him, if we gave Davis Mills truth serum, would he be happy or sad to have been drafted by the Houston Texans? We'll talk about that next.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.